The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I cannot wait for this one because I use the word with interesting people. And when it comes to the wine journeys for most wine owners and winemakers, it follows a kind of a usual script, which is so normal in life. I originally got into sports because my dad was. But my next guest, Namrantha Prasanth from Solacanthus, which is a Bordeaux winery, joining me now, and a very different story. Namrantha, thank you so much for doing this.
Hi, Matthew. Thank you so much for having me here. And I'm thrilled to be talking today at your podcast. Happy to answer all your questions, whatever you want to know.
Yeah, well, a ton, my Lord. But first, scale 1 to 10, how did I do with your name?
It was perfect.
That is very nice. I wish you were my French teacher in grade 9, because it's clearly not, it was okay. Okay, let's get started. There's so much to get into. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your background, because your journey into wine, into making wine in Bordeaux, it's the most unique story that I've heard. Let's start here. How did you first get interested in wine?
Wine came quite naturally to me when I did hospitality. Mm-hmm. I had a fantastic professor.
And where was this?
In Bangalore, in India. Mm-hmm. It's in the south of India, quite cosmopolitan. So we had I did 4 years of hospitality and I had a fantastic teacher. He did introduce little parcels of wine to us. However, wine was not abundant how it is, at that time. Now we have local people producing wines back in Bangalore, in Nasik, back in India. So wines has found its way across India. But while I was studying, wines were something, related to status and, only the higher class of the society could afford a good wine. But I grew up in India for, about 37 years I was in India, growing up in Bangalore. And I had always a liking for food and wine. And my journey into wine began when I got into hospitality.
What year was that?
2000. That was 2000.
Okay. Right.
And 2004, I passed out and I had a lot of knowledge about food. I had specialized in baking and I also knew a lot about kitchen and a little bit about wines. So in 2004, I finished my hospitality and I was ready to get married to, I was in love with this man. I was ready to get married. And just a month before the wedding, my in-laws said, you can't get married because if you are going to be working, I had a job at that time. I had landed a job and they said, you can't be working because we need you to be a housewife and not a working woman.
Is that the norm at that time in that part of India around 2000?
India is a continent, like I always tell people. Mm-hmm. So you'll have parcels where people are very open-minded, well-traveled. You'll have people who are in the upper class of the society who also have women in the house. They prefer that they don't work because it's a social status saying, we don't send our women out to work because we are capable of taking care of them.
Right.
And also because, you find parcels like that across India. So I fell into the family where they actually said, we don't send women out of the family to work because we don't want them to, we can take care of them instead of working. So a lot played on then. And then I got married into this very traditional South Indian family. But to really answer your question, going back to how I got into wine, that was the hospitality. But also the second time that my encounter with wine was when I did in 2007, when I was slipping into depression after, I don't know how many years of marriage, 2004 to 2007, 4 years of marriage. Mm-hmm. And I was slipping into depression when I had my child. It was postpartum depression. And right. I remember saying, I need to do something about that hollow feeling that my soul going down deep inside. And I knew that I was slipping into depression. And I said, I need a challenge. I don't need therapy, but I need a challenge. And when I looked at things around me, I said, one day I sat and said, why not do a language? Because language, my aunt in Germany couldn't speak a word of English. And I thought it would be best to do German. So Goethe Institute was quite far away. I couldn't sneak out and get back inside the house. So Alliance Française was, you know, 10 minutes away from the house. So that's how I've, you know, ended up learning Alliance French. And then eventually I did, you know, level one, level two, and then level three, B1. And I was still doing B2. But, you know, my in-laws came to know that I was doing French, and my husband did come to know at some point of time. But I was already done with a certain level of French. And then I stopped studying. But after a couple of years, in 2013, my child had turned six. And that's when I decided, okay, can I, you know, see what my value in the market would be. So I sent out a resume with a little line saying skills, French language. And in a couple of hours, I got back a mail saying, could you come for an interview? We are an IT company. And yeah, that's where it all started. But to answer your first question, wine?
Well, here, let me make it, because, yeah, it was such a big question. Okay, first of all, I got to go back. The job you landed that your in-laws at that time said you have to stop. What was that job?
It was the chef job.
The chef job. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
I won't probe too much just into the depression, because mm-hmm. obviously there's many factors there. Was part of it that you were feeling you had more to give, and that you were sort of feeling like your potential was being tamped down?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because I knew I was capable, like many other people that I saw around me, you know, going for work. I had ideas. I wanted to do so many things. But also during those 4 years that I was in the marriage, I also tried to do baking, because mm-hmm. I had specialized in baking. I was taking little orders for cakes and chocolates and, you know, things like that. And during Diwali, I would get a bit more bigger orders. But somehow, it was not encouraged. It was, you know, always looked down upon in the house. And then finally, when my daughter turned six, is when I said, okay, I need to do something more. Well, the depression also was because, you know, I wasn't doing anything, and my circumstances in the house was not great, right?
Yeah.
Just sitting at home and cleaning and cooking. And there was nothing that was exciting about that job and being a housewife. And basically, my insecurity of being financially unstable at that time played a lot.
Yeah, that can be an anchor. That can keep you trapped in a bad situation, especially when you have a child, because then finances get involved. You said before you had tried little bits of wine. Do you remember any of them? Was there one wine that you tried that you're like, oh my God, what is going on? This smell, this taste, this is fantastic.
In India, you wouldn't get great wine.
Right.
So this was like the local, the cheapest, the terrible wine. What my professor did was he explained about Ikem. He explained about these
right.
wines from Bordeaux. Yeah, he had a wide knowledge about the French wines, and yeah, we got a little glimpse of it. But when we tasted wine, it was always, you know, this nice feeling about, you know, swirling the glass.
Yeah. So all the physical parts to it, and maybe the actual quality of the wine wasn't great. So then how do we get from you studying French and you doing all this baking, and, you know, there's part of you that has this passion for wine. How do you go from that? And we'll get to the final product now. But where you decide that you want to be in the world of wine.
Going back to the time when I finished Alliance Française mm-hmm. and I landed a job in 2013. So this job in 2013 that I'd sent out my resume
right.
and they sent me back an email saying, you know, why don't you come in for an interview? I had no hope that I'm going to get this job. And I wasn't even sure that I'd be allowed to, you know, do this job, knowing that they wouldn't allow a working woman in the house. What I did was I went for the interview. By the end of the interview, it was all an interview in French. So by the end of the interview, they said, you're hired. We'd like you to go to Paris and train in Paris for a month.
Right. Okay.
And I said, oh la la, oh my God. That was a moment that, you know, I would keep with me forever, because I hadn't expected that. When they said that, and a part of me said, oh my God, such a lovely opportunity, but, you know, it's not going to be possible in my current situation. But I went back home. I called a friend of mine who's very close to me, my best friend, and she's seen me through the marriage. And she says, you know, do whatever you have to do, you know, and, you know, just get your husband to sign those papers. And then finally, I kind of convinced, and after a month, I could leave. And it was like I tasted freedom. I was free like a bird. I could do whatever I wanted.
How excited? I'm sorry to interrupt. I just have to ask. I'm sorry. Oh, no God, I feel bad to interrupt. How excited were you on that plane?
Oh, my God. My heart was saying, yay, yay, yay. Yeah. And when I went there, you know, Paris is Paris. It's charming. It's beautiful. I would go to work from 7 in the morning to 4 in the evening. I was working at La Défense at that time for Société Générale. I mean, I was actually astonished with myself, because when everybody would have a conversation or they would crack jokes, I would laugh at that joke. So getting to a level in French where we could laugh together was something great. After that, I had a wonderful time visiting the Louvre and Eiffel Tower. And I went back to India after a month feeling like, you know, this is a great life, but, you know, I have responsibility. And I felt that, you know, it was like a dream, but I go back and I still continue with this job and I have my daughter there. So I was ready to give up everything for family again, saying, you know, I'll go back, but I'm going to try and keep this job as much as possible.
Of course.
Yeah, and then I continued working. Once I was there, I continued working. But the more I worked, the more conflict at home, the more stressful it became to handle situations. The more, I must say this, the more the abuse, the more the violence, because not a lot of women openly talk about these things. But I'm openly talking about this because there was abuse and violence. And by the end of that year, I had to quit, because either it was my peace of mind or it was, you know, the job.
Right.
So, yeah. So I did finish 1 year of this job at Société Générale, and it was for an Alton Kalsoff Labs, but I was placed in the bank. Anyway, after that, I retired to being a housewife for a couple of years. Yeah. And, you know, I had tasted freedom. I had become a little rebellious. I must say this.
That must have been so hard when you came back, because before you left, you'd only could have an idea of what a different life could be like. And then for 30 days or so, you got a taste of it.
Absolutely. And the most astonishing thing for me was my capacity to adapt and my capacity to be as equal without any kind of experience, just being a housewife, to be in a situation like that, working with people around me. And I felt like, you know, I was capable like the others. I could work, I could earn, I could do things on my own. And I felt like, you know, I should not be constrained.
Right.
Yeah, I went back, worked for a year, and then I quit for 2 years. And then by 2015, I had landed another job because I was feeling desperate. I said, you know, it was a lot of insecurities. So, you know, I said, I'm going to definitely try again for a job. And my best friend was working in LinkedIn, so she said these are the openings, and she got me an interview, and I did well in the interview, and she was really proud of me. I landed that job, and I was there for about 5 months. They were amazing, but the first day of that job, I remember going back crying to the company because my husband had broken the laptop of the company. So it was a very stressful night. You know, he didn't want me to work. It got out of hand. And next day morning, I had to have a sad face going back to the company. But they were an amazing company. I actually, the first day we were having a meeting, and I fell flat on my face because of all that stressful night that I've had. And they said, you know, you need to go and rest and come back. They were really, really nice. And I still had my job for a while. Fast forward to that, after 5 months, it was still getting difficult at home. I had the choice either to leave my marriage, or I had to continue working, or I had to make my marriage work. So with a lot of convincing, with, you know, being a woman, I would say you want to put your family first. You know, you want your husband I mean, probably being a man too, I mean, nobody would want to, you know, let go of a family. You try and do as much as possible to keep the family together. By the end of 5 months, I said, you know, I need to quit. It was the hardest decision that I had to make, but I had to do it. And then I quit. We went counseling for a little while, I remember, and things were a little better. But there was one fateful night when we had a very difficult situation again, where myself and my daughter, we were thrown out of the car in the middle of the night.
Out of the car in the middle of the night?
Yeah.
That is scary.
Yeah, at 2 in the morning, actually, not in the middle of the night. So we were driving back from a friend's party, and and my husband said, get out and, you know, take your daughter with you. And we got off the car and we went back home, really struggled to even think that he could do something like that. And most of this was also brewing because no doubt my husband loved our daughter, but also it was a patriarchal family, and a boy in the family was always very
prized.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and it was a situation where he was upset about something, and we just got thrown out, and I went back home. And we left. I left with my daughter, my dog, and went back to my parents' house. And my parents were really, really supportive of us, which a lot of families in India may not be supportive like my parents, right? So we went back home, and I had to restart life after that, basically thinking, what am I going to do? And we all sat together. I remember my parents trying to advise me, my sister and her husband trying to advise me. And it came to a point where they were suggesting options for me. And my father said, you know, he's more risk averse. So he said, you know, why don't you get into teaching in a French speaking school because you know how to speak the language. My sister was more adventurous. She said, no, you need to get out of here. Just go to a different country. Do whatever you have, whatever you're passionate about.
Right.
So she made me sit and list out whatever I was passionate about, and she made me look up universities across, and what I was passionate was about the language and a little bit about the wines when, you know, I had a taste at Alliance Française also about wines. And and food. I loved the three. So I said, I'm going to do something. I was 37 at that time. I didn't want to do something in finance or anything like that, something heavy. So I moved to France, to Bordeaux, directly from India.
I appreciate your honesty. That must be a hard story to tell. Just anytime having to relive that and just feeling trapped and feeling your life was going down one path that would be fulfilling in terms of your daughter, but so many other parts of your life wouldn't be. And nothing that I can understand. That is a harrowing tale. I appreciate you telling me that.
Thank you.
And it's funny. Part of me feels, well, now let's get into wine. But, that's a very just important story that you told. So, again, I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's so now you're in Bordeaux. And by the way, like, just the crazy thing about this story is anyone that's been listening the last 15, 20 minutes isn't going to realize I'm talking to someone who, at the time of the recording, you knocked it out of the park with the LCBO. They're really interested in your wines. Your wines are all selling out here, the ones that have been allotted in Ontario. You have a Bordeaux white and Bordeaux red. It's a right bank, so I imagine a Merlot dominant wine.
Absolutely, yeah.
So let's get back into it. You're now here. You're not going to work in IT. You're not going to work at LinkedIn. Food and wine, and it's funny. If you baked and you love food, it makes sense that getting into wine, that's kind of hand in hand. So then how do you get from there to becoming a winemaker or wine owner in Right Bank Bordeaux?
Okay, first thing, I don't own the vineyards. So I have this brand, and I work with two winemakers for this brand. Mm-hmm. How I got there was, so once I left India, I went straight to Bordeaux, and I had a month of school before they told me that, you know, go away and do an internship for 5 to 6 months.
Right.
I sent out my resume, and the Chateau Siron in Margaux, they hired me because I could speak French and English, and they needed somebody to be the ambassador. Ambassador meant, you know, people would come tasting from all around the world, and, you know, we welcome them, and they taste the wines, and, you know, we take them around the chateau, and so on. So
Bordeaux, by the way, much better than Burgundy when it comes to wine tourism. Bordeaux, they open the doors. In Burgundy, they tell you to bugger off.
Yeah, yeah, I think, yeah, it's it's a tough situation there. Yeah. I mean, the first day when I got that internship, and I took my bags, I packed my bags, and I had packed 3 chocolatines, right, into my bags. I went to, in the little train that goes up the Medoc, and I land in Mako, the station. And I get out the station, and I look for taxis. I look for Uber, but I couldn't find anything. So, you know, I'm desperate to get to the chateau because you don't want to miss, you know, on the first day to be late, right? Yeah. So, and I'm trying to hitchhike.
You're trying to hitchhike in the middle of a dock.
Yeah.
That can't be
easy. So there are these people driving across thinking, what is this Asian woman doing in the middle of the countryside trying to hitchhike? So it didn't work out. So I called my manager, and she came and picked me up. And luckily, she was wonderful, and she picked me up. And they had provided me with accommodation over there. What I didn't realize is that I would be living by myself, and there wouldn't be anybody in the chateau or in the area.
That's very isolated. That's your countryside. There's not a lot of people.
Yeah. Though the Miai family, who are the owners of the chateau, they did come from time to time if they had somebody visiting or people. They would be there, and those were the days when I would be, wow, okay, that's great, I have neighbors. But the rest of the days, I would be by myself. But the first day, actually, because I had 3 chocolatines, by the end of the day, I had finished those 3 chocolatines, and Erica, who was my manager, by the end of the day, she comes to me, and she says, Nam, you probably will need to go and do some shopping because, you know, you'll need food to eat for the next 1 month or whatever. So she gives me the car keys, and, you know, she gives me directions to go to supermarché. I remember it was so stressful that, you know, it just kept fading in my head, those instructions. And anyway, I had Google. But when I got to the car, and I, you know, this old white truck where you tend, you know, where you use it for the vineyards. I sat in that truck. I was sitting on the wrong side in the truck, and I was like, oh my God, okay, the steering wheel is on the other side. It's not on this side like in India. And then I take the truck out, and I go on the little road, right? And I'm driving on the wrong side of the road. So I'm going on the other side. And I have this car coming right in front of me. And I'm like, oh no. My God, I'm driving on the wrong side of the road. So I move to the other side. So after a couple of minutes, it was okay. I found my route and, you know, did all the shopping, got back. But that night was so scary because I was all by myself in the middle of the countryside, 88 hectares, a nice, lovely chateau, woods, the vineyards, a cemetery, a church, and the river. So, yeah, I think it took me about 3 months to really get over that fear of living alone. Mm-hmm. And that's when I was watching a lot of the LCBO videos about wine, because when I typed in wine videos, I would get Jancis Robinson's and LCBO Michael Fagan's videos there. And at some point of time, you know, when I was listening to Michael's lovely voice, I wrote on to Michael on LinkedIn saying, hey, Michael, this is these videos are amazing, because I worked in LinkedIn. I knew, you know, I could connect with professionals, and I had no clue that he would, you know, even write back, knowing that it's Michael Fagan. But he wrote back saying, you know, it's amazing that you're enjoying these videos. So, well, we'll come to that after. And Michael is the reason that I'm here today. Mm-hmm. We'll come to that after. But yeah, that as the story goes, I was there and I finished about 5 months of internship. Around the 5th month, I met with a huge accident. I was on the highway. We were 5 people in the car. We crashed at 130 on a Sunday morning. We were going to Spain. I was jetted from the back to the front, and the whole windscreen was shattered. Thankfully, I was not out of the car. I was still in. And when I woke up, I felt this surreal moment where it felt like I was out of the car. Somebody had just picked me out of the car and placed me back, you know, after a while. The airbags were out. There was smoke. And I remember somebody getting me out of the car and putting me on the grass. And I think everybody thought I was dead.
Right.
The ambulance came, the pompier, they came, they picked me up, went to the hospital. They scanned me head to toe. I had like a little ligament tear and two tiny fractures on my toes. So it's evident that, you know, there was some guardian angel or somebody who was
You deserve
really
some good luck, by the way. Let's just say you deserve some good luck.
Thank you so much. So, but what happened after that was quite astonishing because I had this memory of from my childhood that kept coming back to me more often than earlier. So this memory goes back to when I was 8. I was with my cousins on the beaches of Pondicherry, which was a French colony a long time back. And my aunt, who lives in Toronto now, my aunt and my cousins, they all live in Toronto today. But they lived in Pondicherry for about 7 years when we were younger. And we used to go to their house for summertime. And they used to take us to the beach every evening. So it was a thing to do. And one evening, my cousin was near the sea, and you know, I could see some, you know, in the dim light, it was dusk, and I could see a little bag kind of thing washed up near his feet, and he was beckoning to me. So I ran towards him, and you know, without even thinking, I looked down and I see this beautiful face shining in the moonlight. I pick her up and I drop her instantly because it's not a doll, it's a baby girl. It's a real baby. I could feel the skin. I still have that touch. I cannot forget that touch.
Mm-hmm.
Female infanticide was rampant at that time. It, as we talk today, it is still existing, but much more lesser than how it was earlier. People, it was mostly linked to dowry, because when you had a girl child, you would have to pay a lot of dowry when she got married. Right. And she would become a kind of burden to the family. So nobody wanted a girl child. So, yeah, that's the society we were growing up in. And this memory of that child kept coming back to me once, you know, after this accident. And I said to myself, if I'm living today, it is because of there's something that I have to, you know, finish in this universe, in this world before I leave.
Right.
I took that up and I said, whatever I do from today, it's going to be the end goal would be empowerment of children, education of children, empowerment of women, not only in India but across the world. But we'll start with India.
And that's and some of the sales of your wine goes towards the education of children, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. Towards tribal girls in India. So I work with an organization called Mukul Mother Foundation for this,
mm-hmm.
and they are amazing. They do a great job in India.
Tell me about at the Vine Expo Trade, 2019, you start your business Wine Equation. I'd like to hear about that.
2019, I met Corinne. And
who's Corinne?
Corinne is the winemaker of Chateau Belair La Royale, mm-hmm. and she's also the winemaker of Solicantis.
Mm-hmm. How did you guys meet?
We met at Vine Expo.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we hit it off really, really well. She invited me to her vineyard. She said, you know, why don't you come take a look at the wines? And she was speaking to me about the growing season of the wines, like the gestation period of a woman. And then you have the harvest is almost like a delivery of a child. So we really hit it off. We had a good laugh. And, you know, and since then, I've been working with her to get out the red Solicantis Rouge. And there was one point of time where I asked Corinne, can I bring out a label? And she was really nice and she said, yeah, why not? So we brought out a label, and it kind of took me about 4 months to understand what the consumer would like to see on, you know. I didn't want to bring out another bottle with a white label with a chateau on it.
Right.
I just wanted something that was more attractive to the consumers. I wanted to actually, the whole idea was to bring out Solicantis was also to have a giftable wine. You give that as a gift, and you can also pair it with a bunch of red roses. For the white, you can pair it with a bunch of white roses or any kind of flowers.
Yeah.
So it could be a perfect gift for anybody during the year, Christmas, summer, you know, Valentine's Day. That was the whole idea. And I like to paint. I paint from time to time. Now, Solicantis is also an the label is an inspiration from the paintings of Salvador Dali. Mm-hmm. He uses a lot of implied lines. And these implied lines, you know, talk about the story, talk about a journey. So I use that implied line to talk about the journey of the wine in a vat. So the swirl that you see on the bottle is the journey of the wine in the vat, basically. So you'd see the darker part of the red, it's the must, and the clear wine at the end of the cycle. So once I had the label, I was wondering, what can I call it? And I took to Latin. In Latin, soli means soil and cantus means melody. So it's the melody of the soil. So it's basically,
that's a great title.
Yeah.
All right. Let's reverse engineer a little bit your role with Solicantis, like in terms of how much you involved in when like the blend, when grapes are being picked, all the process, you know, the decision of where you're going to buy your grapes from, things like that. What is your role in them with all of that?
For major things like effeuillage, deleafing, and green harvesting, I go to the chateau from time to time. I used to go more often, but now it's more commercial. Mm-hmm. Right. I do the harvest, of course, with everybody. We do machine and we do hand harvesting. So that's my role. And I work with Corinne, of course, to she's an amazing woman. I place the order and, you know, she packs it and she helps me with the orders. So a lot of winemaking is also selling the wine, right?
Yes, of
distribution
course.
And exporting. So, yeah, I think we are a good great team actually.
What did you guys see in each other? Because I think I want to fill in a couple of blanks. You meet this winemaker at Vin Expo, and now you've got this great label, and you've got the you're making wine. Where are the grapes sourced from? I know it's Right Bank, but where, what appellation, where is it from?
So this is from Côte de Bordeaux, Blaye. Côte de Bordeaux, from the appellation Blaye.
Yep.
We also have, I don't call it Blaye on the label, but it's Côte de Bordeaux. So we have about 5 appellations that we can put into the Côte de Bordeaux category.
Yep.
So it's called Côte de Bordeaux. The white, it's from Entre-deux-Mers, mm-hmm. from a yep. little town called Gournac. Both wines are, I mean, the white winemaker is Jérôme from Château Martineau, and he's a fantastic winemaker. I think the 10th generation winemaker. He's an artist himself, so yeah, he treats his wines like an art. Yeah.
And what did you guys see in each other? Because to suddenly meet to decide, let's team up together and make wine, that's a very ambitious project.
I know, because I needed to settle down, even, you know, because I was either looking at getting a job or I was looking at starting a business. So for me, sending out resumes, you know, it was difficult to get a job. There wouldn't have been any kind of stability because you're always looking for interns, right? So by the end of it, I said, my brother-in-law, who is a financial advisor back in India, he was saying, you know, you're 37, you should really start a company of your own. Work hard and, you know, you'll see the results. It'll take a little bit of time. But he was a kind of mentor to me. And I wouldn't have been here doing all of this if it wasn't for my sister or my brother-in-law
right.
or my parents actually stepping in and saying, we will take care of your daughter and, you know, you leave. And all the financial aid that I've got throughout those years, it's been incredible. I'm here today, you know, talking to you is because my family has been so supportive. And I wish all the families back in India and across the world listen to this, because whatever the circumstances is, you need to support your child. And
yes.
then you can have miracles after that.
These wines here are representative of winemakers, of people working in the vineyards, your own perseverance, but it's also your family.
Absolutely.
Like these wines represent the love of your family, the support of your family. And it's a reminder that every successful person comes from a base of people that love them to help elevate them, as your family's done for you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Tell me a little bit about the white wine we got here. On the nose, the palate, I'm assuming Sauvignon Blanc, Semillon, Muscadel sort of blend. What do we have here?
Absolutely. So, Matthew, I request you to swirl the wine and close your eyes and sniff it.
Yeah. This is like a mix. It's got the non-aggressive Sauvignon Blanc green notes. There's a little bit of sweet fruit in there. A little bit of like white rose. It's a very pretty fragrant, nose on this one is what I'm getting.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for saying that, because I always tell during the tasting that it's almost like you're walking into a garden full of fruits and flowers.
Yep.
It's very intense in aromas, and
yes,
a lot of people love these wines because of that aromatic profile. So this is a blend of Semillon, Sauvignon Blanc, Sauvignon Gris, and Muscadel. Yeah, so it's 60, 25, 13, and 2.
So it's a Semillon based. Well, Semillon's the base.
Higher, okay. Higher quantity of Semillon.
One thing, it's funny because I've done some other Bordeaux interviews recently. And it, one of the common themes is I've always been telling people, try more white Bordeaux. You know, for people that love Sauvignon Blanc, great. For people that like the body of Chardonnay, perfect. White Bordeaux has enough body, and to me there's a little bit of spice on the finish of it. You know, there's a little bit of complexity. I would say that this wine is high end simple sipper, and by that I mean you can just open it, drink it, enjoy it. But when you pause and you start thinking, what have I just done the last 12 seconds? You're start going to be hitting all these different notes. So, you know, that's why. Because sometimes, first off, there's nothing wrong with simple sipper. Making high quality simple wine is not easy to do. But then add to that, there's a lot of depth going on. A lovely white. And also just different enough that I always recommend people try white Bordeaux, because it'll give you a very different experience to your white wine world. And what do you on the palate? What is it? What do you get on this fella?
So I'd say citrus, a lot of orchard fruits, and it tails off with this little hints of tropical fruits, pineapple, yeah, lychee.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Little hints.
Papaya, lychee is right there on the end. Yeah,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's a very easy wine. This wine we've experimented with a lot of dishes. Mm-hmm. So yesterday we did a dinner for 70 people at Joe's restaurant in Ottawa, and it was a big hit. And I was, you know, we were David Krewine, and we were discussing about the pairings. And Joe actually said, "Hey, you know what? We have dahi vada on the menu." So dahi vada is something very difficult to, you know, to pair with wine, because it's yogurt based. Any yogurt dish is very difficult to pair with wine. So I find it difficult. So when I saw the word dahi vada, I said my wines, Solicantus, go amazingly well with dahi vada, because we have done tastings in Bordeaux with Indian food and these wines. So we actually switched the pairings and served Solicantus with the dahi vada, and everybody loved it.
Nice.
Yeah, and it's quite versatile. You could have it with seafood. You could have it with with pasta. You could have it with any Asian dish, spicy.
You could, you know, it's funny. They talk about like the high acidic white wines of like Greece and Spain and Portugal. And, you know, like this, you could have this in Santorini sitting by the water with just like a whole bunch of different crustaceans and white fish.
Absolutely. 100%, yeah.
The red, you know, doesn't take a genius to know. I'm assuming this is going to be a Merlot dominant wine. That would be my guess.
That's true. Yeah. It's 90% Merlot.
Okay.
5% Cabernet Sauvignon, 5% Malbec. Mm-hmm. So we have about 18 months of oak aging on this one. New oak barrels, 50, and secondhand barrels, 50. Mm-hmm. The wines are quite aromatic again.
Yes.
Has a lot of red fruits, black fruits, cherries, maraschino cherries. And the tannins and the fruit and the acidity, they're quite well balanced, I would say. The 2000 was more fruit forward. This is, I think, we have achieved a nice balance between fruit acidity and tannins. Has a nice complexity on the nose as well as the palate. Try it.
The same as your white, it's just fragrant and pretty are some of the first things that come to mind on the nose. Mm-hmm. But you're right. There's a nice sort of balance between the red and the dark fruit on this. It's I find actually the white one has more of an aromatic punch than the red, which is not meant as a criticism or a compliment, just as a fact. Yeah, a very nice, pretty nose. I took a sip. I'm going to take another sip in a second. But yeah, yes, balanced. I'm not getting any hot heat on the back.
Yeah.
Medium tannin on it. Nice, refreshing acidity. And what I like to say, it has that Merlot hug. Like Merlot is just, it's got this nice sort of embrace. It's not always going to come and attack you the way sometimes Cabernet does. It doesn't have this like funky Pinot. It's got a little bit of everything and just this nice, restrained, jammy hug. I'm always nervous about using the word jammy because that denotes too hot. It denotes flabby, poorly made. And that is the last thing that I would want to say about this.
Yeah, I'd say it's quite an elegant wine, and I'm really happy to be working with both Jerome and Corinne because they're fantastic winemakers. And the best thing about them, they're very flexible and they're available all the time. And I feel like even though I work with as partners, it feels like a team.
Cherry chocolate, a lot of cherry chocolate on the finish. Yeah, that's just that's a nice wine. That's a fun wine. And even then, I'm nervous about using the word fun because even that makes it seem frivolous. Like, you know, this has seen plenty of oak, new old oak, old oak. Like this would be what I would, if I was serving someone in their mid-20s who wanted to get in Bordeaux, but I didn't want to start them with the big brooding, mushroom, earthy floor, which by the way, I love those wines, but you got to bring people in. You got to bring people in. And this one's got more than enough of the old world Bordeaux-y thing going on. But that cherry chocolate on the finish, the fragrant fresh nose on the beginning. This is the wine I would get to start to hook people onto Bordeaux. I think maybe one way I would describe it.
Yeah, I think, you're absolutely right. It hits that spot between an easy drinking wine or a gourmet wine, right? It's that spot in the middle.
Your wines, part of the profits go again towards education for children in India. So, I mean, just an incredible, just an incredible cause there. Where can people find these wines? What do people need to know?
So the wines can be found in Belgium with Verivino, in India with Sonneries, and in France, a little across in Paris and in Corsica, and a little bit in Bordeaux. It can also be found now thanks to Crew Wine Merchants. They've been an amazing team and got wines here. And it can be found in a lot of restaurants they've been ordering across Toronto and Ottawa. Yeah, the reason I'm here today is also because of Michael Fagan, whose videos I was watching of the LCBO.
Yeah.
And Michael, at the beginning of this year, he writes to me and says, Nam, would you like, can we invite you for Rootstock, which was a symposium that took place in George Brown College.
That's right. How did that go?
Because that was fantastic.
That went well.
Yeah, very, very well. We had a great response, and everybody was really happy to talk about. I was really happy to talk about the wines. They were happy to hear and listen. They were a great audience. Michael also introduced me to Crew Wine Merchants, and that's how Crew has, we did a Zoom, and I was so happy working with them. So yeah, the wines are here. So I'm really happy.
They're being released at the LCBO by the time this podcast is out. And if they're not, keep an eye, for Solacanthus, because I know they're going to be released at a bunch of LCBOs across Ontario as well.
It should happen soon.
Yeah.
But the moment, actually, just before I came in, flew into Toronto, I had this moment where my daughter turned 16, and I had planned this birthday for her in Arcachon. And she came in the middle of the pandemic, right? 2020, right. It was a tough year. She was supposed to come in March, and somehow the world turned topsy-turvy. So actually, we didn't talk about this because that's when I launched my company, Wine Equation, in February 2020.
Oh my God, you picked just the worst time to do it, didn't you?
And then that was the same time I was hoping, I was battling to bring my daughter here. And and the world turned upside down. And, as everybody experienced it, the first month you're thinking, okay, it's a small little virus.
Right.
It's going to go away.
Yes, we all did. It's like, oh, don't worry. By the fall, we'll be back to normal.
Yeah. So by the end, I remember by the month of May, I was wondering, if this is ever going to go away. So one day it actually sunk into me that this could be a long term. And I had a new brand. I had left my daughter there. So I had a lot of, I had put a lot at stake, to be here and do this. So I remember crying a whole night and waking up with puffy eyes and saying, I'm not going to give up. I've come so far. I'm going to do, you know, things differently. So that's when I started talking about the brand, talking about the wines. And Tom Mullen, who writes for Forbes, and at that time when he interviewed me, I didn't realize he was writing my article on Forbes. But, you know, he interviewed me, and one day he called me and said, you know, Nam, your article is up on Forbes. And I was like, oh my God, I'm up on Forbes.
I've read it. It's a really good piece.
Thank you. Yeah, he's done a great job on that.
Yes, he did.
And that changed a lot of things. And Jane afterwards, Jane wrote an article on Decanter, and she's lovely as always.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Jane was one of the best wine writers today.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And and then a lot of interest from India.
Jane Anson, just for people.
Jane Anson, yes.
Yeah, for people
that
don't know, Jane Anson, writer for Decanter. Go find her. She's fantastic.
and a lot of media followed after, and they were wondering, what is this Indian girl doing in Bordeaux, you know, with this brand? And I'm blessed. And then I had my daughter come in that same year by September.
Good.
And she started school with masks and everything, without knowing much of French. She knew like a few words of French. So she went to eighth grade, fully French speaking school, 8th, 9th, 10th, and she's done fabulously well for herself. 8 months was really, really tough, the first 8 months. But anybody who's listening to this, don't be afraid to, you know, to let your child experience changes, experience challenges, because as parents, we might, you know, want to protect them.
Yeah.
But, you know, once they have that experience, they're going to be thankful. My daughter wrote for Mother's Day, she wrote a little note saying, thank you so much for putting me through that, because now I'm highly skilled with two languages.
when you read that, did you also get puffy eyed?
Oh, yes, of course.
Have you had a moment where has she walked through? The vineyards, has she walked through the vines where your grapes come from?
No, I think she still doesn't understand a lot of it.
Yeah.
So I think it'll take a few more years. Yeah. But she's done well for herself. And there was this moment before I came to Canada. It was her 16th birthday, and I was, it took a lot to integrate her to the French system, mm-hmm. to living a life in France, to both of us, because also I had left her for 4 years. And when I found her, when she came to France, she had just started teenage. So it was those years of hormones, and it is still the years of hormones, but, you know, understanding each other, living with each other again. In spite of me going back and forth, you know, those 4 years, it was really hard for both of us to, you know, begin living as mother and daughter, and she finding me in a different environment here in France, and me a businesswoman before I was a housewife. And
she probably wasn't used to seeing that all the time.
No,
back
not at
in
all.
India. And then, like, she might have looked at you as a rock star, as an alien, as this strange, like, it might have been a little bit of all those things wrapped into one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But then, you know, over the years, she's come to understand how this whole world works and how France works. And she's integrated amazingly well in Bordeaux. She mm-hmm. has a lot of friends. They go for sleepover. So during her birthday, we had a chef friend of mine. He said, you know, I have this lady who, you know, you can hire the boat from her. And we did this thing in Arcachon where we took about 10 kids, and I was sitting in the back of that boat watching the kids dive in and come back on the boat, and I said, oh my God, we've come this far.
Wow.
That was the moment I said, this is our second life.
That is incredible, considering there was a moment many years earlier where you and your daughter were kicked out of your then husband's car at 2 a.m. to go from there to where you are now. This is a hell of a journey. Congratulations, Nam.
Thank you and so much, Matthew.
Yeah, congratulations. And for anyone listening, like, you know, we always say that one of the keys to selling wine to people at a restaurant or consignment or wherever is you sell the story. This is one of the more remarkable stories that anyone can hear. And again, I got nothing else to say but congratulations, and thank you for sharing it with me, Nam.
I'm very thankful and grateful for you listening and giving me this platform to share the story.
Yeah.
And I hope that a lot of women stuck in difficult situations, you know, take strength and courage and do something different with your lives, it is possible. If me, a simple girl from India, can do this, I think anybody could definitely do this. Yeah.
I can't wait to see what you got next. I can't wait to see future vintages. I can't wait to see just whatever your future projects are. This is the incredible start to your journey.
Thank you so much, Matthew.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, Spotify, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.